This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
19th. Amy will speak about her new book,
Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times.
The event will be held at the Pavilion Royale Event Center in a fundraiser benefiting KPFT.
Tickets to the event are $15 pre-sale, $20 at the door. In addition, you can get preferred seating to the event, a copy of Amy Goodman's new book, and a ticket to the exclusive reception with Amy for $250.
Folk music performer David Massengill opens the event at 6:30. Amy Goodman will speak at 7:30.
Again, Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, comes to Houston for a live speaking engagement on Thursday, April 17th.
The Pavilion Royale is wheelchair accessible and is located at 5800 Airline Drive.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
I'm Deborah Bell.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
And this is Brian with the Y Lavinka.
There you go.
And before you start, Glenn, I'd like to make an announcement that we are now available on iTunes.
Wow. Get out.
Yes, yes.
Which you can listen to on your iPhone.
Right, or you can listen to it on your
iPod.
It actually...
It used to be the me generation, now it's the I generation.
Well, all you need to do is open up iTunes and go to the podcast area and do a search for KPFT, and there are a number of our programs on KPFT that are available, and you can download like the past four or five shows. And I mean, you were able to do that before, but it just is a lot easier within iTunes.
I was off last week because I went to see the Gay Men's Chorus, and it was a fabulous show, one of the best I've seen. So I appreciate being let off for the evening. And
we could work without you, can't we?
Yes, I'm so relieved. Glenn, what's up for tonight?
Well, on tonight's show, it's being called The Case of the Missing I. No, The Case of the Missing T. T for transgender and the inclusion of transgender in non-discrimination law. The Human Rights Campaign has found itself the target of protests in several cities over the past few months, and there's one planned for the HRC fundraising dinner in Houston this Saturday. Phyllis Fry will be here to explain why and discuss the ins and outs of transgender inclusion in the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, also called ENDA. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Allison Vogt is the Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence Specialist at the Montrose Counseling Center, and she will be here to discuss how the issue impacts the GLBT community. On This Way Out, lesbian writer Jane Bowles and her gay husband Paul Bowles, who lived in Morocco from the 50s through the 70s, have forged an unusual platonic and artistic partnership. And Waiting for Giovanni, a play about the pivotal moments in the life of pioneering gay African-American civil rights activist James Baldwin. And, of course, News Wrap with the latest GLBT news. But first, we go to Washington, D.C. for Queer Voices correspondent David Elliott and his Inside the Beltway and Beyond report. Hello, David.
Are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
Okay, welcome. Well, David, I want to know if you're actually reporting from Washington or from Scranton or Lancaster or Harrisburg.
I'm actually in Washington, D.C. tonight.
You're where? You're in D.C.?
I'm in D.C.
Well, what's the word in D.C.?
Well, you know, I have to tell all of you that Democratic Party pundits inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. tonight are baying at the moon. They're wringing their hands. They're crying into their beer mugs. And what might I ask is the unreasonable and rather outlandish cause of all of this consternation?
You tell us.
Well, shock. Oh. There's still a presidential primary election going on.
Indeed there is.
And people are upset. Some of the Democratic Party pundits are upset that it's April already, and Lord forbid, we don't have a nominee yet, and oh my God, they're saying, it's going to hurt the Democrats in November, and some people are saying that Hillary Clinton should withdraw. And I am here tonight, and full disclosure, I'm a Barack Obama supporter. Although if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, I will proudly vote for her. But I'm a Barack Obama supporter, and I'm here to tell you tonight that the people who are worrying about this primary going on and there being two strong candidates still heading into Pennsylvania and then Indiana and North Carolina and Oregon and Montana and the other states, the people who are calling for Hillary Clinton to withdraw are just wrong. And I'd like to share a
couple of... That's right. They sure are, David.
they are. And
tell
and
us why.
I'd like to, first of all, read you a couple of quotes from a great blog that I read today that kind of lays out my reasoning here. And then I have some additional thoughts to offer on top of that, if I may. Here's a quote from a great blog. Quote, Pat Leahy and others who call for Hillary Clinton to bow out early are wrong. Unity in the Democratic Party will not be achieved by capitulation. It can only be achieved by the universal recognition of Obama's victory. And that will only happen after Clinton loses one or more states. Ironically, the unity of the Democratic Party requires that Clinton must remain in the race for another month until she loses and the inevitable becomes apparent to her strongest supporters. Clinton supporters will feel strong resentment against Obama if they feel that his supporters pressured Clinton to end her campaign early. By contrast, that resentment will disappear if Obama can prove his decisive victory by winning again and again and again. It's not just the feelings of Clinton supporters that we should worry about. The worst thing for Obama right now would be to win by default. A win by forfeit only weakens the winner in the realm of politics. By contrast, Obama's victory over Clinton would establish momentum, showing his ability to defeat a powerful political machine. Now, a couple of points I would like to add to that blog. As it notes, Democratic strength is more easily achieved through unity rather than through capitulation. If Obama supporters are viewed as driving Clinton from the race, it is going to be much more difficult for everyone to reconcile than if she fights the good fight and he wins. Second, I'd like to note that in every state where Clinton and Obama compete, Democrats are left stronger. The Democratic candidate has a real chance of beating McCain in Texas this November, and Missouri, and Georgia, and New Mexico, and Nevada. We lost every one of those states in 2004. Now, a couple of observations. I don't know, you know, Deb and Jack, if y'all noticed this, but both Clinton and Obama were campaigning in Montana this
yes.
past weekend. Now, what was that all about? Granted, Montana has the last primary of the season, along with South Dakota, but it's not like the, you know, seven or so delegates from Montana are really going to decide anything. So why were they there? It's because Democrats are trying to expand the playing field this November. Move it out west in 2004. You know, let's recall that 4 years ago in 2004, I mean, move it out west in 2008. I don't want to be looking backwards.
Please don't.
In 2004, John Kerry, our nominee, only carried 19 states. In 2000, Gore only carried 20 states. In 1992, largely because H. Ross Perot was on the ballot, Bill Clinton carried a more impressive 32 states. I honestly believe that this election cycle, Democrats are going to be able to put into play as many as 42 states. That's not to say they're going to carry all of those 42 states. That's how many I think are going to be worthwhile their investment. You know, we're going to be competitive in states like Kansas, Montana, Virginia, Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, maybe even Arizona, John McCain's home state, Texas, Georgia, North Carolina, and a bunch of others. And there's another point that I would like to make. If you've been listening to the campaigns, the campaign speeches of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in the last few days, they have largely stopped criticizing each other. Now, their aides continue to snivel and snipe, and, you know, this could change if, you know, if Hillary Clinton decides to throw a Hail Mary towards, you know, in Obama's direction, if Obama decides to respond or find something new to attack Hillary on. But to me, this is really starting to feel like a basketball game where the team that is behind finally sort of decides to concede. You know, no more last-second fouls, no more desperate three-pointers. And instead, you kind of hold the ball and dribble and pass it a couple of times for form's sake, and then you start to move on. That's what it feels like to me, and that's why the calls that we've been hearing from some of Obama's supporters and also from some of the neutral folks in the Democratic Party for Hillary to withdraw are, in my opinion, ill-conceived. Now, Jack and Deb, y'all probably want to comment on that. If we have time in a minute.
Oh, you know I do.
If we have time in a minute, I'd like to say a couple of words about the issue environment, but let me just stop right here.
Well, Jennifer is with us, too.
Yeah, don't forget me.
I'm leaving out Glenn, is that correct?
Yeah, everybody wants to forget the tea, you know.
It's not because of that. Dave is just not used to your voice. And, yes, Glenn is here in the studio along with Brian Levinka. And I agree very much with much of what was said in that blog about the prematureness of any kind of withdrawal. Don't, at least in my memory, which, you know, of course, is getting fading by the day.
Come on, Deb. You're not that old.
I'm getting there. But Democratic... don't they go to the convention without knowing who the candidate is oftentimes?
That pretty much happened in 1980 when Senator Kennedy was challenging President Carter. It certainly happened in 1968. Now, in 1988, when Jesse Jackson was challenging Dukakis, I might be confusing Mondale and Hart in 84. It wasn't really decided until a couple of weeks before when basically superdelegates cut a deal.
Uh-huh.
So it's typically the convention is a coronation.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if you don't have a numeric majority by the time the primaries are over, usually the superdelegates sort of, you know, make their presence known. So it's 6 of one, half a dozen of another.
Well, not only are not all the primaries taking place, but a lot of the state conventions haven't taken place. And I think some things could come out of that. I mean, for us, having two strong, wonderful candidates to choose from, I still support Senator Hillary Clinton, and I would like to see a Clinton-Obama ticket. Now, that being said, you know, people debate, well, would that be, would it be an Obama-Clinton, or what all could happen on that? We don't know. But one of the things, like in my precinct, which was fairly divided between Obama supporters and Clinton supporters, when we got to our Senate district meeting, we got to know each other a little better. We worked with each other. And now we're kind of uniting to have a stronger precinct. So come November, whoever the candidate is, we're all going to be involved in getting that Democratic candidate elected. So I think, you know, the fact that people have come out in unprecedented numbers here in Texas to take part in the process, that alone is just like, I feel like we already won something from that.
Oh, and Deb, let me share a couple of statistics with you, if I may. Excuse me, because I'm really excited about this. But do you know that more people participated in the Tuesday night caucus in Texas on March 4th than participated in the 2004 Democratic primary? And do you know that more people voted in the March 4th Democratic primary last month than voted for John Kerry in the general election in November of 2004? And I was running some numbers today.
You love those numbers, don't you?
I love those numbers. And you know, Jack's going to love this, because I know he's from Pennsylvania. There are four suburban counties around the city of Philadelphia. All of them have always been reliably Republican, right? Ever since the 1960s. Today, we know that for the first time since the 1960s, two of those four Republican suburban counties around Philadelphia have more Democrats registered to vote than Republicans.
And that's
that
really
shocking.
That's really interesting, because there you have, when you register, you register as a Democrat or Republican or independent. You can't just change your mind when you go to vote in the primary.
Right. And you know, something to, I want to say something, in saying this, I want to address both the Clinton supporters and the Obama supporters, and kind of I also want to address what Deb was just talking about, you know, her senatorial, her state Senate convention, and how the two sides were coming together and talking to each other and agreeing to work together. Let us point out, you know, let us point out everything that these two candidates have in common. Both are committed to ending the war in Iraq and bringing the troops out quickly and responsibly. Both are committed to launching a concerted drive for energy independence. Both are committed to universal health care for everyone and for raising taxes at the very top end to pay for it. Both have suggested significant investment in infrastructure, our schools, pre-kindergarten, affordable colleges, Lord knows our bridges, and other forms of infrastructure that I can't even think of off the top of my head. Both have pledged to push for union workers, the right of workers to organize. Both have pledged for, you know, environmental protections and protections for our food, our water, the air that we breathe. You know, there's so much that these two candidates have in common. In fact, in some ways, that's why sometimes the race gets kind of personal, mm-hmm. because there aren't really that many policy differences between.
And they both have addressed GLBT issues unlike any other presidential candidates have in the past. Hillary Clinton was on the Ellen Show today and made a very strong statement about being supportive of GLBT rights. There's a buzzing. I don't know why. Are there bees in here? Also, and I know you read it because I sent it to you, David, the article by Helen Thomas.
Right, the longtime UPI reporter.
Right, where she talks about how premature it would be for Clinton to withdraw and how unfair it is for people to be saying that. You know, and it's interesting that all these people that have said that are people who lost their races.
Right. Right.
So you said you had a few other comments.
Yeah, and I know I'm running out of time here.
Well, we've got, you know, a little bit more time. We've got some fudge time in here.
You know, we have to compare the coming sea change election this November. It's going to be a sea change election for the Democrats. We have to compare it to 1980, when Carter was knocked out by Ronald Reagan, ushering in a new era of conservatism. Now, I'm making a reverse comparison, mind you.
Thank you. I was wondering where you were going with that.
Right. But consider what the atmosphere was like in 1980. We had a dismal economy. We had double-digit inflation. We had rising unemployment. We had soaring gas prices. We had rising interest rates. We had a sharp recession. We had something called a misery index, which was hitting a new record. Voters considered the economy to be the overwhelming issue, but they were concerned about the Soviet Union invading Afghanistan. They were concerned about revolutions throughout Central and Southern America, South America. They were concerned largely about Americans held hostage in Iran. The country in 1980 was looking for change. And you know what? Ronald Reagan ended up with one-fourth of the votes of self-described liberals. Can you believe that, Deb? And 26% of registered Democrats. Now, compare that to 2008. We have an economy that's in a recession. Gas is headed to $4 a gallon. Incomes aren't keeping up with the costs of basics. Housing prices are cratering. There's a sublime crisis. A subprime crisis.
Which is hardly sublime.
Yeah, it's very sublime. Once again, the economy is the number one issue in voters' minds, although I personally think it should be Iraq, but that's just me.
Mm-hmm.
Already more voters today are more pessimistic than they were in 1980. 63% of voters today think the economy is getting worse. 58% thought that in November of 1980. I could go on and on and on. 2 weeks ago, the Pew Research Group showed that only 29% of Americans identify themselves as Republicans, the lowest that's been since they started polling on this issue some 18 or 20 years ago. So we are looking at a sea change election. We Democrats have to keep united. We have to keep it together, whoever our nominee is. And we have to reach across, you know, our partisan aisle and be very gracious. Obama supporters need to be very gracious and appreciative to the Hillary supporters and where they have brought the party. And where it's possible, the Hillary supporters need to be able to, reciprocate and reach over and recognize perhaps the new energy that the Obama folks have brought into the party, if that's possible. And
some of us old folks still have some things to, that we're concerned about.
Well,
sure,
and
that's going to happen. But we got to get it together by November.
Right, and this is all very, very important. And is as important as the top of the ticket, so is the bottom of the ticket. And in fact, here in Texas, we're having a runoff election tomorrow, and the Houston GLBT Political Caucus has endorsed two candidates on the Democratic side. One is for Railroad Commissioner Dale Henley, and one is for District Judge, the 80th Judicial District, Larry Wyman. And it would be very much advised that you vote tomorrow, but before you vote, go to harrisvotes.org to find out where you're going to be voting.
Is this the runoff election day itself? It's not early voting?
Early voting was last week.
Okay.
So this
it went by so fast.
Yes.
Tomorrow we have to go vote.
Right. And there's only 35 polling locations for the Democratic Party tomorrow. It's mostly where the early voting locations were, but you can't go to anyone. You have to go to your particular one. So look up harrisvotes.org. Most of Montrose will be voting up in the Metropolitan Multi-Service Center at 1475 West Gray.
Harrisvotes.org.
Yes.
Okay. And David Elliott is the Communications Director at the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. He joins us the first Monday of each month talking about issues inside the Beltway and beyond. Good night, David, and thank you for being on Queer Voices. Now to News Wrap from This Way Out.
Destination, I'll carry the load.
Phil Dutra, Another Day Alone, from his 2007 EP, Right Behind the Rain. This is Queer Voices.
I'm Sherry Lunn.
And I'm Lee Moore.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending April 5th, 2008. The European Court of Justice ruled this week that a company offering pension benefits to the married partners of its workers must also offer them to legally recognized same-gender partners. The case was brought by Tadeo Maruco, a 65-year-old gay German man, after the company his deceased partner had worked for rejected his spousal pension benefits application because the couple had not been legally married. Germany provides limited rights to same-gender couples, but not marriage. Maruco fought the case for 3 years, first losing in a German lower court. An appeals court eventually referred the case to the Luxembourg-based European High Court, asking if domestic partnerships should be considered equivalent to marriage and if the pension fund had discriminated. In its written ruling, the Euro Court said that the refusal to grant the survivors' pension benefits to life partners constitutes direct discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation if surviving spouses and surviving life partners are in a comparable situation as regards that pension. The decision returns the case to German judges to formally decide the status of the pension. Analysts say it sets a precedent for companies and governments throughout the European Union that offer any form of legal recognition to same-gender couples.
But queer rights groups in Ireland have expressed disappointment that the government may not extend parental rights to same-gender couples as part of new legislation to legally recognize their relationships. The Irish government is scheduled to announce the details of their civil partnership bill in the coming week. The country's media are reporting that the measure will cover such areas as pensions, social security, property rights, and taxes, and will also recognize same-gender marriages, civil unions, and civil partnerships from other countries. But regarding the denial of parental rights, Grainne Healy of the group Marriage Equality told the Irish Times that while any legislation in this area is welcome, if these reports are true, it is of great concern that gay and lesbian people will continue not to have the same rights as heterosexual couples. The government says marriage itself is off the table because, according to Article 41 of the Irish Constitution, the state pledges itself to guard with special care the institution of marriage, on which the family is founded, and to protect it against attack. It doesn't, however, define the institution itself. So some critics and constitutional scholars argue that the article doesn't specifically forbid same-gender marriage. Meanwhile, plagued by corruption charges, Prime Minister Bertie Ahern resigned this week, but activists don't believe that will affect the partnership legislation. Ahern, a vocal supporter of LGBT rights since he first took power in 1997, spearheaded several legislative advances during his tenure.
Greek lawmakers are considering a measure to legally recognize gay and lesbian couples through a civil ceremony, according to a report this week by the country's Net TV. The country's justice ministry was said to be establishing a group on the rights of same-gender couples living together, which would, quoting the report, analyze all aspects of the issue, international practice, and the existing domestic legal and social framework. The new democracy-led government is expected to introduce legislation later in the year that will offer several rights to unmarried couples. The Minister of Justice has already told the media that while it won't establish marriage equality, the government opposes discrimination and will therefore include same-gender couples in the civil union's legislation. The announcement has upset the Greek Orthodox Church. Its governing synod described the proposal as a catastrophic bomb, which threatened Greek society and compared such action to prostitution. But a lesbian couple in Athens reportedly has or soon will celebrate their marriage, officiated by the mayor in the city's Kessariani quarter. Activists hope they found a loophole in the Greek civil marriage law because it refers only to participating persons without specifying gender.
Greek LGBT activists are already celebrating their government's decision to grant asylum to a 40-year-old gay Iranian man. Known only as Alex, he was arrested, beaten, and tortured in his home country because of his sexual orientation. His two previous political asylum applications have been rejected, and he was facing deportation. The advocacy group Greek Homosexual Community led a campaign on his behalf and issued a statement this week saying, We are happy to announce that the gay Iranian refugee known as Alex was finally granted asylum following the reconsideration of his case. The status of Iranian gays and lesbians seeking asylum based on their homeland's treatment of sexual minorities has caused controversy in several other European countries, including Great Britain and the Netherlands.
In other news, police in Beijing raided and closed two gay bathhouses in late March, according to information circulated on queer Asian mailing lists in China and Malaysia. The March 26th report, which carried the byline of well-known Chinese AIDS activist Wan Yanhai, said that 70 patrons and employees had been taken into custody in a raid on the city's most popular gay bathhouse, Club Oasis. Patrons were released 30 hours later, but staff members remained behind bars. It said another Oasis bathhouse in the city was raided the next day and that the staff, but not customers, had been detained. The report said a third bathhouse may have met a similar fate, but provided no details. It also included a list of other recent alleged police actions against gay men, including a bar raid and temporary closure, roundups in well-known cruising areas, and arrests of sex workers tracked down via their web postings.
But in the U.S., an Arizona oversight panel has given final approval to Democratic Governor Janet Napolitano's plan to provide domestic partner benefits to state employees and retirees. The LGBT advocacy group Equality Arizona called it a defining moment for Arizona. Benefits would be available to both same and opposite gender couples where one partner is or was a state worker. The Grand Canyon State boasts a significant population of heterosexual senior citizen couples who prefer domestic partnerships to remarriage for Social Security and tax purposes. So including opposite gender couples in the plan was likely a key factor in its approval. Arizona joins 13 U.S. states, the District of Columbia, hundreds of major companies, and some 200 communities nationwide offering some form of domestic partnership benefits.
And finally, two stories about American federal tax dollars at work. First, Democratic U.S. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi reportedly had to intervene when the Pentagon refused to allow the same-gender partner of Representative Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin on a military flight taking congressmembers and their spouses on a fact-finding trip to Europe. The lawmakers visited France, the Czech Republic, and Poland last month. According to a report this week by Politico.com, Pelosi had to call Defense Secretary Robert Gates directly. She urged him to follow the precedent established by her Republican predecessor, Dennis Hastert, who didn't object to Baldwin taking her partner of several years, Lauren Azar, on an earlier trip. Gates told Pelosi that he'd approve Azar for the trip once he received a letter from her authorizing it, but said any future requests would be handled on a case-by-case basis. It's hardly the first time that the Bush administration has been accused of LGBT discrimination. Special Counsel Scott Block, the person responsible for protecting whistleblowers and investigating complaints of discrimination in the federal workplace, has refused to act on any involving sexual orientation. U.S. Ambassador to Romania Michael Guest also resigned last year after the State Department refused to recognize his male partner.
And the State Department this week refused to issue a U.S. passport to Jason Hare Wynn of Attleboro, Massachusetts, because he hyphenated his last name after legally marrying his boyfriend in the Bay State. The local Sun Chronicle newspaper reported that the U.S. State Department informed Hare Wynn that if he wanted to renew his passport, he'll have to legally change his name back to what it was before he got married. He's an HIV/AIDS counselor who's scheduled to begin work in July at orphanages in Ghana. A letter to Hare Wynn from the State Department specifically cited a section of DOMA, the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, passed under the administration of then-President Bill Clinton in 1996, which states that in determining any ruling, regulation, or interpretation of the various administration bureaus and agencies of the United States, the word marriage means only a legal union between one man and one woman as husband and wife, and the word spouse refers only to a person of the opposite sex who is a husband or a wife. Hare Wynn told the newspaper that he can't even process this. It is weird to get discrimination in writing. He said the Federal Social Security Administration gave him a new Social Security card with his married name on it, and the State Registry of Motor Vehicles reissued his documents as well. But Hare Wynn says that working with kids in Ghana is more important than fighting the State Department. So he'll change his name again so that he can renew his passport.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 5th, 2008. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
This is Queer Voices.
With us on the line is Phyllis Fry, which I consider one of my very dear friends. And first of all, Phyllis, I want to thank you for that great event that your law firm hosted a week ago Friday on the top of, well, sort of on the top, halfway up of a skyscraper
on the
downtown.
Deck level,
yes,
yeah.
That was really an interesting thing to be in Houston because you don't usually think about that being there, like, you know, like in New York or something.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and I consider you one of my very dear friends, too, and it was a lot of fun. I was amazed at how beautiful downtown Houston
yes.
looks at dusk
yes.
from the 15th floor terrace.
Yes. Well, you're here talking to us about the HRC event, their gala that's coming up this Saturday night, and the fact that the national HRC, is not being very inclusive with ENDA, and that you're sort of spearheading this protest.
Yes. Well, let me be very blunt. I am calling for people to join me in protest. But some people have, and I won't say who or how many, have been appealing to me as to how I'm going to control the people that show up. There's only one person that I can control, and that's me. Everybody else is going to be there exercising their First Amendment right to speech. And how they exercise that right, I can certainly give them guidelines on how to reduce their chances of being arrested. For instance, don't bring a sign that has a stick on it, because that stick could be interpreted as a weapon. But anyone has the right to yell and scream and march on the sidewalk and carry a sign. And, you know, so be it. But, yeah. I put out the call, and I'm getting a lot of responses. I think we're going to have a lot of people show up.
Phyllis, this is Jennifer.
Renee. Hi, darling.
Hi there. I just wanted to touch, you know, for some people, I know that there are people who have been living in caves for months now and may not understand what the protest is all about. What's the motivation for it? What has happened to cause this outrage?
Okay, in 1994, the newer or more recent edition of the ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, was introduced in the United States Senate. And this was a rewrite of ENDA that was a much stripped-down version of earlier versions of ENDA. It was paid for mostly by the Human Rights Campaign, and the principal author was Hi Feldblum, who's a professor of law at Georgetown University. She and her team worked with HRC to put together something that they thought might pass in 1984. And as I said, it was a very stripped down version of what had been asked for a decade or two earlier, beginning with, bless her heart, Bella Abzug. It was not transgender inclusive. And I was there in Washington, D.C. at the Senate hearing the day it was introduced. And as I chatted with people in the coalition that were introducing the bill, I learned in 1994 that HRC in 1993 and 94 had taken the lead on making the decision to not include transgenders in that in the bill. I found that it was very interesting because during the testimony in 1994, opponents of that in the bill were complaining about men showing up work in high-heeled shoes and sequin dresses. So they weren't really concerned about gay people having sex at work. What they were concerned about is gender expression. But that wasn't in there. This started about a 10-year war with HRC that I was not the sole and only leader, but I was a major instigator. And finally, in 2004, HRC became one of the very, very last organizations to include transgender in its mission statement. So now we're in 2007, new Congress, Democrats in charge of both House and Senate, first time since 1994, and they decided they were going to introduce a new end of bill, and this time, because HRC was supposedly inclusive, it was going to be transgender inclusive. It was going to include the terms, quote, sexual orientation and gender identity or expression, unquote. And it was backed by HRC and all the other organizations around the country. Well, when September rolled around, Barney Frank, representative from Massachusetts, started getting cold feet, and he was afraid that it might not win. I understand from my sources that openly lesbian representative Tammy Baldwin had the votes, but Barney Frank was afraid, and so Barney Frank started talking about introducing a sexual orientation only bill. Interestingly, Barney Frank was the one who also went chicken on gays in the marriage back during the Clinton presidency, and he therefore compromised and gave us the notorious Don't Act, Don't Tell. Barney Frank is a political chicken, and that's all there is to it. Anyway, so HRC was hedging its bets, and they said, no, we're in favor of transgender inclusion, but if the sexual orientation bill only is adopted, we'll back it. And so there was such a fallout that there came a organization called United ENDA, and it was spearheaded by the task force, the National Lesbian Gay Task, Gay and Lesbian Task Force, by PFLAG, and by just a whole bunch of other major organizations. And when it was all over, well over 300 had signed up in support of the inclusive end of bill and in opposition to the sexual orientation only end of bill. The argument has always been that a law that protects sexual orientation only will not protect very many gay, lesbian, bisexual people. It will protect the gay, lesbian, bisexual people who pass for straight. But any gay, lesbian, bisexual person who expresses gender differently does not live in a sex stereotypical male or sex stereotypical female role will be discriminated against and will not be protected. And that's the problem. If you are a gay man or a lesbian woman and you're a little bit effeminate and have a hard time hiding it, or you're a lesbian woman and a little bit butch and having a hard time hiding it or don't want to hide it, even though the little bit is just a little bit, if you are discriminated against on the basis of your gender expression, you're not going to get any protection under sexual orientation. And that's what the whole fight has been about. Obviously, they cut out the transgenders, but they are also omitting well over half of the lesbian, gay, bisexual community. So HRC is the one that headed it up and backed Barney Frank on this fiasco. And so we're going after the money, HRC's money, and there have been fundraisers around the country. Ours is not the first, but there have been demonstrations in other cities, and many elected officials from other cities have not shown up. Many of the funding people have dropped out. I know I have a lot of friends around the country who used to send their money to HRC, and they don't anymore. So we're going to protest HRC to make sure they know when they come to Houston that Houston is a GLBT unified city, and that we don't like throwing half of the community into the grease, and that we're going to protest.
One of the things that I know a lot of people don't understand is, and I want to go, this is simplistic, but the current bill that was in fact passed by the House was just sexual orientation only. And when you talk about an inclusive employment non-discrimination, you're talking about one that includes sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and gender expression, the or expression, really pertains to a number of other things, some essential protections we've received through the courts, is it not?
That's correct. Title VII, which was written in 1974, prohibited discrimination on the basis of sex. And that was interpreted in 1989 by the U.S. Supreme Court in the case Pricewaterhouse versus Hopkins. This was a woman who was in the accounting firm Pricewaterhouse. She'd been there for a number of years. Her name was Ann Hopkins, and she had been passed over for a partner several times, and she was told that if she wore makeup, she was told that if she acted a little bit more feminine, she was told that if she wore higher-heeled shoes, she was told that if she went to charm school, she was told that if she was less aggressive and more submissive like women are supposed to be, that she would probably make partner. And so she sued Pricewaterhouse, and the United States Supreme Court said that such sex stereotyping is a discrimination based on sex. And so as the years have slowly progressed since 1989, Pricewaterhouse has been interpreted slowly, very slowly, beginning in 1999 in Schwenk, to protect transgendered people as well. Now what we have is legislative history where a bill that was going to codify the gender expression part of the end of bill, that would have codified or put into statute essentially Pricewaterhouse, was turned away, and a vote was refused, and a bill that was identical and omitted those words was passed by the House. So now there's legislative history so that when all of these Bush federal appointee appellate judges decide they want to trash Pricewaterhouse, they can say, oh, well, there's legislative intent. They had a chance to codify Pricewaterhouse by including gender expression, and the Congress chose not to, so this court will not uphold Pricewaterhouse. And
Phyllis, has there been any, since this passed the House, has there been any cases that have showed up anywhere, maybe not in federal court, but other places?
Well, I wish I could give you the citation off the top of my head. I cannot give you the citation, but I know there has been one that actually, I'm sorry, I can't give you the details.
That's okay.
But I know there is a case where a judge said, well, you know, if the federal Congress has had the chance to vote on gender expression and they decided in their wisdom not to vote for it, then that's congressional intent, and I'm not going to uphold Pricewaterhouse.
Now, so as of right now, even though that bill didn't pass the Senate, it hasn't gone any further, hasn't been vetoed or signed by the president, it's already affecting the GLBT community.
Yes, it is.
In a negative way.
Yeah, and you know,
is Barney Frank aware of this, or has he still got his head stuck?
Who?
Barney Frank.
I don't know about Barney Frank. I can't control Barney Frank. but I need to say that this is just 2 days ago introduced in the U.S. Senate, and it was introduced as a sexual orientation only bill by Ted Kennedy.
On the Senate
3 days
side.
Ago.
On the Senate
it was either
side.
Thursday or Friday of last week.
Right, on the Senate side.
Yeah.
So it's moving forward, I guess. Now,
Well, first of all, let's get some information on if people who are interested in joining the protest on Saturday night, are they to show up? Or do they need to contact someone? What's the information on that?
All they need to do is to show up. Anytime, we're going to be there between 4:30 and 7:30.
And where is here?
Here, downtown, the George R. Brown Convention Center area, where the Hilton Hotel, the Convention Center Hotel is.
Hilton Americas.
At the corner of Polk Street, P-O-L-K Street, and the Avenue of the Americas, which is the street that runs in front of the Brown Convention Center.
Yeah,
right there at that corner.
It's that big hotel right next to the center.
Absolutely.
Downtown.
At Polk and Avenue of the Americas, if you'll show up, if you want to bring a sign, bring a sign. If you want to bring a piece of poster paper and a mark slot and make your sign there, that's fine. If you show up without a sign, that's fine. We will divvy you up. We're going to have three different teams on the outside. And on the inside, we're going to have a team that's going to be very cordially and with smiles on their faces approaching attendees and handing them lapel stickers that say that if you put this on, then you're telling everybody else there that you support a full GLBT inclusive agenda.
Good, good. Now, is there anything we could do as far as Congress is concerned?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you can join, if you're in Houston, you can join the Houston GLBT Political Caucus. I know this is being heard around the world through the internet, so if you're not in Houston, you can join whatever GLBT political organization that you have in your city, because it's these political organizations that endorse political candidates, including members of Congress. Every single member of Congress is up for re-election this year. And one-third of the United States senators are up for election this year. The party primaries, for the most part, with the exception of a few that Obama and Clinton are still battling over, have been held. But you have the chance to get active and support and vote for people who have been screened by your political organization who will support inclusive GLBT issues and laws.
Thank you. Phyllis, is there anything else we've not covered that you want to make sure gets covered?
No, not really. I'm just hoping that a lot of people show up. I do not expect there to be any problems. I just don't see it because I know that, I can't speak for the local HRC, but I personally feel that many of them are embarrassed about what happened, but they feel that they need to go forward. I hear from some of them from time to time, and they keep saying, you know, we got to have this incremental approach, and we got to have this incremental approach and get some people their rights now and get some of their rights a little later. I was doing some historical research recently, and I was reminded that in the 1830s, during the abolition movement, there were a lot of women involved in that. And when the Civil War was over and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed, freeing black people, the only ones that were given the vote were the men. And so all of these women who had been in there were incrementally shown the door and had to fight for another 60 years for the passage of the 19th Amendment, which became law in 1920. And even during that fight, the majority white women were constantly marginalizing the minority black women in the women's suffrage movement. And the parallels were so striking that I was just stunned by it. Yeah. Because our history is replete with people who are wanting their rights, and they want other people to help them get their rights, but they don't want to extend the full rights because they're afraid, for some reason, of offending conservative bigots.
Well, that says it all right there. Phyllis, I want to thank you very much. Is there any contact information that we can put out?
You can always get me through my email address at prfrye@aol.com. And if you are interested in this kind of information, if you will simply send me an email and say add, I will add you to my filibuster e-blast, which I send out from time to time, that concerns these issues. And that's prfrye@aol.com.
Thank you, Phyllis. Thank you, and good luck on Saturday.
You bet, my dear.
All right. Good night. This is Jennifer Renee, and this is Queer Voices.
In order to protect the sanctity of marriage, is it enough to keep the queers from getting hitched? Stopping there just puts the proverbial horse behind the carriage. Why not attack the problem at its very source? It's time to outlaw divorce. That's right, if we can't get married, you can't get divorced. If gay people can't tie the knot, straight folks have got to stay together till death do them part, no matter how miserable they are. No more celebrities like Elizabeth Taylor, with more ex-husbands than anyone can recall. No more annulments coming from the Church of Rome. No more divorce attorneys getting filthy rich. No more relief from the 7-year itch. Because if we can't get married, you can't get divorced. If gay people can't tie the knot, straight folks have got to stay together, if only for the kids. No matter how bad their marriage is, you'll say your vows, they'll throw some rice, all dressed up and looking nice. And now guess what? You're stuck for life. Woman and husband, man and wife, protect the sanctity of holy matrimony. Amend the Constitution to reflect this little change. No more second chances, no more alimony. If marriage needs defending as they claim, take another look at who's to blame. If we can't get married, you can't get divorced. If gay people can't tie the knot, straight folks have got to stay together, whatever it takes. The sanctity of marriage is at stake.
Something new from Romanofsky, The Sanctity of Marriage. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
I am happy this way.
I'm happy to be gay, too.
Yes. And that's why they call it gay, because, you know, we're happy.
Exactly.
April is a lovely month, you know. April flowers. And the showers that bring the Mayflowers.
Yes.
We thought it was the Mayflower that brought the pilgrims.
The weather's
anyway.
Right, right. Springtime.
It's springtime. And it's like, it's nice to kind of think about, oh, you know, let's not think too much about politics and let's take a break from all this. But there's always something going on that we have to be conscious about.
What is that, Deb?
Well, in you know, they have, you know, different months, lobster month,
there's
or, you know, breast cancer awareness month, right. Or whatever. Well, April is sexual assault awareness month, and Allison Vought.
Vote.
Ooh. Like
to vote.
Yeah.
Like
to vote.
Political.
We all know
it's
that.
Not spelled that way, but that's the way it's pronounced. Allison Vought is the sexual assault and domestic violence specialist at the Montrose Counseling Center. And we're going to talk to her about how the issues of sexual assault and domestic violence affects the GLBT community.
Mm-hmm. It does affect the GLBT community, and I don't think a lot of people particularly realize that it does. But the incidence in the GLBT community is the same as it is in the heterosexual community. 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused throughout their lifetime, or assaulted at some point. And in the domestic violence, as it comes for domestic violence, it's 1 in 4 relationships in the GLB community will have domestic violence in a relationship. And in the transgender community, it's 1 in 2 relationships, which is a really startling number.
Wow.
Yeah.
So and that's equal to the same as heterosexual couples?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't think that. You know,
we'd like to think better of ourselves.
You would hope so, but I guess it's not that way. So what is the counseling center doing to kind of... for this month to kind of get the word out?
What we're doing is we've launched a consent campaign, which is really exciting. We had a focus group last year once we got a prevention grant, and in that focus group we had a really nice young lady come in, and she told us that she felt like the community didn't know a lot about consent and weren't asking and giving consent for sexual acts. And so the magnificent Sally Heffer.
Oh, we and, pause a moment for the diva,
exactly.
Sally.
And Richard Muska is my supervisor, and I sat down and we started talking about what consent means. And we came up with this idea that, oh, and I must add that it's Sexually Transmitted Infections Awareness Month as well. So this kind of ties in.
What a coincidence.
I know.
Those kind of go together.
So what happened was we decided that it would be really cool if we started from the beginning with our condom packs. And it's kind of a different sort of program. But what we've done is we've made these consent cards, and we've put them into our condom packs. And we're asking people to get consent from their partners before talking about the condom, before having sex. And so what essentially the consent cards do is it kind of explains what consent is, which is one person who legally agrees to have sex with another person. And it tells you who can't give consent, which is a minor under the age of 17 or someone who's legally intoxicated with alcohol or drugs. Mm. And it allows the reader to know that there could be legal ramifications. They're not always legal ramifications, but there certainly could be.
Well, if someone is intoxicated or on drugs and you give them this form, they're like, yeah, honey, I'll sign it.
It's not a form. You're just asking.
Oh.
Yeah.
So it's like a little card reminder.
But by law,
it's a consciousness-raising tool in hopes to start that dialogue.
Exactly. And you can't
We used to do that as part in the National Organization for Women, as part of, for young women, dealing with date rape, and also just making young people aware that what you're entering into is somewhat of a contract, and that what the ramifications, to use a term, could be. You know, everything from disease to pregnancy to emotional attachments to on and on. So it's a very clever idea.
Okay, you're at the bar, you meet someone, you go home. How does the whole interaction play out? I mean,
well, it depends on the people. You could be really clinical and be like, "Will you consent to have sex with me?" Or you can
define
be
define sex.
Oh, yeah, that depends on you too. But it could be something that you just kind of come up with. And actually, we thought it would be really fun to have listeners send us an email with their funniest, sexiest, most clever ways to ask for consent from your partner.
Oh, good idea.
What's the email address?
The email address is mcc2@montrosecounselingcenter.org. And I was thinking tonight on my way over here, it would be kind of fun to have a party where it would be a fun party game. Let's come up with the best ways to make Allison and Sally Heffer completely blush and just, oh, I can't believe it. Somebody wrote that to us. And then what we're going to do is we're going to share those with the community. So then the community has a way of talking about it.
So this conversation will be continued because mm-hmm. then we'll be very anxious to hear those responses. Oh,
I would love to hear what people come up with.
Yeah, I have a feeling they're going to be good.
Yeah.
The other thing about that is a lot of people will say that they feel weird asking their partner of several years.
Yeah, if you've been consent. In a relationship, it's kind of just, you know, routine, you know, going through the motions after a certain point. Yeah. How does that work? So?
Well, you know, you want your partner to respect you and to be and you want them to feel like you respect them, you respect their body and their boundaries. And a lot of times I think when people get into a relationship, they're kind of like, well, they're my partner, so they want to have sex, so I guess I'm going to have sex with them.
Okay, I guess.
Yeah.
Tonight's the night.
God, if I have to.
Exactly. It's that whole, honey, I've got a headache, but we want to come up with a better way to do that. And so having an agreement with your partner, just something funny or something that's sort of like a little password, just to ask, like, do you want...
Hey, I'm feeling frisky.
Yeah. And then if they're
is
like, no...
Is it poker night or no?
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, no, you don't.
No pun intended. Well, yeah.
Well, I was thinking it would be funny to say something like, is it bunny time? Is it bunny, you know, and just kind of like... And then they can say no, and if they say no, then you know, maybe they'll say tomorrow night or whatever.
Yeah, tomorrow. Well, see, in gay couples, it seems like, you know, it's not really putting it off. It's like, oh, you know.
There's never enough time.
There's never enough time. I don't know.
But it's true that sexual assault does happen within partnered relationships where one partner is actually not willing, who isn't wanting sexual contact, has said no. And mm-hmm. is forced to have sex.
And that, yes, that does occur, especially in relationships where domestic violence occurs.
So let's say we're in worst case scenario, you're in a relationship where there is abuse. What can our listeners do? Where can they go?
Well, they can come to Montrose Counseling Center and talk to me.
Of course.
That's why I'm here. They can come talk to me. We have a hotline. They can access it through just the basic Montrose Counseling Center phone number, the 713-529-0037 number, or they can call the Gay and Lesbian Switchboard of Houston, and they will kind of tell them where to go and how to contact us. You can call me directly at that number. My extension's 339, and I'd be absolutely happy to offer services. If you've been sexually assaulted, we have hospital and police accompaniment services, so you don't have to feel weird about going and telling a police officer that you were sexually assaulted.
So do I call the police first and then call Montrose Counseling Center or the hotline and say, I need someone to go with me to the hospital?
Yeah, you can do that. And actually, I prefer that you would call us first, so then you don't have your first experience with a law enforcement agency or the police or the hospital, and it's bad, because that's one thing that
it
prevents people
is.
from wanting to report. And so what we want is for an advocate to be there,
right?
Because if something is said, then the advocate can calm the person down, they can right. talk to the person who said that, make a report if need be.
It can be an extension of the violation that's already occurred. Now, is there a group also for sexual assault survivors?
Yes, we do have a group for sexual assault survivors. It's we'll be starting it up again soon, and they can contact Montrose Counseling Center. Our groups are also listed on our brand new website.
A new website.
Still montrosecounselingcenter.org, just fancier. And the other thing I do want to mention, because we're trying to prevent sexual assault, we're trying to prevent people from sexually assaulting. Mm-hmm. Because all of the prevention efforts in the past have been watch your drink, make sure that you know who you're going out with, always have a buddy with you, that sort of thing. And that's valuable. But what we want to do is keep the community from sexually assaulting, in the sense that if you know who can't give consent, if you have that information, then you have that tool to make that decision. We're not saying yay or nay either way. We're just giving you the information. And it's horrible on both sides when someone is sexually assaulted, because the person who's sexually assaulted may have depression, may lose their job, may eat too much, get an addiction, those sort of things. But then the person who sexually assaults, if arrested, they can get a misdemeanor or a felony offense, and they're going to go up on the sex offender registry. Don't know how much you guys know about this, but in the end of spring, they're going to start listing employer addresses of people who are on the sex offender registry. So it's your home address, your address, your picture, what you look like. Well, everything is up there.
There's a lot of information on that website.
And there's people who may have some misconceptions in thinking that they're actually not committing sexual assault when they, in fact, are.
Legally, by law, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, such as by having sex with someone who's not able to give consent, with a minor, etc. For them to realize, you know, oh my God, we're talking about me, or that's something I've done. I don't want to do that anymore. I want to be, as they say in the S&M community, which I learned more than I wanted to know about when I was working on the March on Washington, is safe, sane, and consensual. Mm-hmm. And I think that applies to all aspects when you partner, whether it be emotionally or physically, spiritually, etc., safe, sane, consensual.
Exactly. And we want to prevent people from getting up on the sex offender registry, as well as we want to prevent people from going through the trauma of sexual assault.
What if you are an offender? What if you have sexually assaulted and
need assistance?
I mean, is there help for people?
There is. There's the Council on Sex Offender Treatment in Austin, Texas. It's through the Office of the Attorney General. And there are different therapists in Houston that specifically deal with sex offenders. And even our therapists may, depending on the situation, because there's, again, the situation, what we're talking about here is just getting consent. These people who may not get consent because they went out to a bar and they got really drunk with somebody and then they went home and had sex, may be now listed as a sex offender, but were they the scary rapist hiding in the in the bush, or were they the pedophile? So we need to...
So the sexual assault could have happened years ago, but a person may still be dealing with it and need assistance. So that's there.
That's our counseling.
I think women are much more aware of the threat of sexual assault. The statistics that you cite as far as the number of girls that are molested or women that are assaulted compared to the number of men. But the number of men, is it 1 in 4?
It's 1 in 6. May be 1 in 4.
Yeah, we don't know.
It has to do with reporting. And we do have a sexual abuse group for our gay population, for our men, because they absolutely need that counseling. I think it's sometimes harder on men in the sense that they don't really have an outlet, and there's a lot of judgments that go along with it.
I can see where, it's a threat to their manhood.
Exactly. And,
straight or gay. I mean, straight men are sexually assaulted as well. And, of course, those of us that listen to Ray Hill on the prison show know about the horrors of prison rape.
Mm-hmm.
I have known a number of gay men who were molested as children or also have been raped as an adult.
Yeah.
I wouldn't wonder where to go, and you're telling us that the Montrose Counseling Center would be a great place to go to get counseling and help.
It's great because we're a GLBT agency. Mm-hmm. There are other centers that I'm sure offer services, but if you're a gay or lesbian, don't you want to go where
you don't have to
teach your therapist about the GLBT community, because our therapists are all affirming.
Yeah.
So it's better to go to your own community. And of course there's confidentiality, so it's not like we're going to go around telling everyone what happened. We're very strict about our confidentiality policies.
Mm-hmm. I imagine there's a lot of shame issues for survivors. Yes. I mean, there is a point where you're a victim. Mm-hmm. And then it takes work to become a survivor.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And those are, yeah, a lot of people use those terms interchangeably, but they're really not.
Right.
You're a victim when it's happening to you. You're a survivor after you've kind of taken care of yourself. And it's really important to get counseling because I've seen so many people just fall by the wayside. They lose their job. Their friends don't want to deal with them anymore. They're tired of hearing about it. They're terribly depressed. And then they become homeless. And then sexual assault is a social problem in the sense that it causes homelessness, poverty. It causes suicide. It causes all the things that you can think of that are kind of bad in the world, all the social problems, domestic violence, those are all caused by sexual violence. Mm-hmm. And so if we can stop that.
And that yeah. aspect of violence is if your partner is physically, you know, maybe beating you up in order to, you know, because mm-hmm. you said no, so they beat you up and they have sex with you, are the people that are going to bars and using drugs are spiking drinks and, mm-hmm. And putting people in compromising positions. I know one of the aspects that you talk about, and I really want to have you on for a more fun kind of show to talk about internet hookups and dating.
Oh.
But that is one of the areas where there are dangers.
There are dangers, and the internet hookups, they can be great. I mean, they're, you know, it's two consenting adults who've decided to do something together, and
Ron shaking his head. Like,
no, I'm just like, it's like a cornucopia of men online 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Well, but it can be also something like at least half of the internet, I think, is all about gay men. I mean,
it's gay men and hooking up, and it's insane.
It can be very dangerous, though, especially if you don't know that person. There are some things that you have to pay attention to, like where you meet and going over to their house and that sort of thing. And I would love to come and talk about it.
There were some cases in Houston where people hooked up online, invited someone to come over, ended up getting beat up, ended up getting robbed, and then they're very afraid about reporting the crime because it was, after all, they put themselves in the position. And I'm not saying you shouldn't. I mean, for me, it's like, oh my gosh, you don't even know somebody and you're together having sex. But you know, that's not for me to say you should or shouldn't. But I would say, as a general rule, just not meeting someone in person before you establish that consent. And it not being like, you know, and having them come to your house or, you know, the element of safety, we do have to be vigilant and we have to pay attention to the dangers that are out there, just like we would warn children about who they might meet online or what's on their MySpace page or their Facebook page.
And I do want to talk about that for just a second. It's funny to me, it's particularly teenagers, but almost everybody, they think they've got a MySpace page, it's set to private, it's private, or they're on one of the hookup sites or whatever. I think we think that that's just in Houston. But what people don't understand is that it goes out to everyone who has internet access.
Yes.
And so if you're posting nude pictures of yourself online, those are being shown to people in Mumbai. You know, so anywhere that there's internet access, that's where the information is going to. That's the same thing with the sex offender website.
There's people all over the world who do not want to see my nude pictures.
So, I mean, always online, be careful about what you post about yourself. Don't post your address or your telephone number. Don't post your email address unless you want the entire world to see it.
Or places you might be at particular times.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of like, cyber stuff.
Oh, I go to such and such jazz cafe every Wednesday. I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's not a good idea. So just being careful about what you do and what you post on other people's pages, on your pages.
Well, Allison Boat is the sexual assault and domestic violence specialist at the Montrose Counseling Center, which is something I wish there wasn't even such a thing as someone that has to do that job. But we've been talking about the issue of sexual assault. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And once again, give contact information. I think Brian might have something he wanted to post.
No, I was just going to say, if you could remind us of the website and the email address, maybe?
Mm-hmm. The website is montrosecounselingcenter.org. And if you would like to send us your funny, clever, sexy ways to get consent, please send them to mcc2@montrosecounselingcenter.org. And just talk about it. That's all we ask, is that we start, as a community, start talking about sexual assault, because we could do something really amazing by ending sexual assault in this community and then being like a beacon for the whole world to end sexual assault.
We can be beacons, Brian.
Well, we already are, but you know, we'll get even brighter beacons. Even, I think, as far as assault goes, I think once is too much.
Oh,
if we can
stop it at
one time, that would be
exactly
monumental.
I agree. Well, Brian Ladinka?
Yes, Deborah Bell.
And we've been talking to Allison Vogt from the Montrose Counseling Center, and thank you for listening to Queer Voices.
From 1977, Sue Fink and Leaping Lesbians. This is Queer Voices.
Black Chicago teen Emmett Till, brutally murdered for flirting with a white woman in Mississippi, and lesbian writer Lorraine Hansberry, best known for her play A Raisin in the Sun, were just two people who influenced acclaimed gay African-American writer and activist James Baldwin. We'll hear from the actor and playwright who are collaborating on a new theatrical production about him later in the program. Lesbian writer Jane Bowles and her gay husband Paul Bowles shared an unusual platonic and artistic partnership. This Way Out commentator Janet Mason illuminates their lives together and reflects on a comprehensive collection of the iconic lesbian's literature.
I have long been familiar with the name of the writer Jane Bowles, the platonic friend, literary colleague, and lesbian wife to the gay writer and composer Paul Bowles. The two of them lived in Tangiers, Morocco, for many years after their marriage of convenience in the early 1950s to Jane's death in 1973. Only recently, however, did the collected works of Jane Bowles, entitled My Sister's Hand in Mine, published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giraud, fall off the bookshelf and into my hands like an old friend, insisting on being read. In the introduction of this collection, Truman Capote describes Jane Bowles as a modern legend who seemed to him to be the eternal urchin, appealing as the most appealing of non-adults, yet with some substance cooler than blood invading her veins, and with a wit and eccentric wisdom no child, not the strangest wonder kind, ever possessed. Jane Bowles was born Jane Auer in New York City in 1917 and raised primarily on Long Island. Her family, her mother in particular, was not happy with Jane's adventures in the gay bars of Greenwich Village and what one biographer calls her open pursuit of women lovers. This, no doubt, factored into her decision to enter into a marriage of convenience with Paul Bowles, after which both continued on with their own separate affairs and long-term relationships. But the two of them together were a literary team, reading and commenting on each other's fiction and being part of a coterie that included such luminaries as Tennessee Williams, Gertrude Stein, Juno Barnes, to whom Jane Bowles' writing has been compared, and later the Beat Generation, including William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg. Jane Bowles had a long-term relationship with a Moroccan lesbian who no doubt influenced the writer's knowledge of Moroccan culture and hence her writing. However, Bowles' writing does not reflect lesbian life, perhaps ironically, in the conventional sense as we know it today. Instead, she explores the confines of relationships, most notably between sisters, perhaps a metaphor for lesbians, or, as one biographer noted, more likely a metaphor for her own sexless but meaningful relationship with her husband, Paul. Most of her stories, if not all, explore both the entanglements and estrangement inherent in the claustrophobia of intimacy. In the introduction, Truman Capote refers to this as human apartness. In a scene toward the end of the short story, Camp Cataract, the narrator explains her position to a woman who works in the camp and who has become fixated on her. I haven't the slightest interest in men, nor in women either, for that matter. As for marriage, of course, I admit I'm peculiar, and there's a bit wrong with me, but even so, I shouldn't want to marry. I think the whole system of going through life with a partner is repulsive in every way. But don't imagine that just because I'm a bit peculiar and different from the others that I'm not fussy about my life. I am fussy about it, and I hate a scandal. Jane Bowles presents some of the best writing that I've read that illustrates how place is not only essential but can become part of the narrator and ultimately the writer. She was self-taught and facile with many languages and traveled and lived in many different countries. The Bowleses spent most of their time in Tangiers, so much so that Capote described them as permanent Tangerinos. The Tangiers of the late 1940s through the 70s, the time period that Jane and Paul took up residence there, was hospitable to artists of all stripes. The visual artist Delacroix in the 1800s painted a timeless record of Tangiers' remarkable colors and light. Tangiers is the northern city of Morocco, set on the northern edge of North Africa. Its stone cliffs are chiseled by the sea, and atop the cliffs stone walls and turrets tower. And up further still are tiny close-quartered whitewashed stone houses, set apart in the interior of the city only by winding narrow streets and foot-worn stone staircases. Jane Bowles, as a lesbian in Morocco, with a lesbian Moroccan lover, became part of the landscape in a unique and subterranean way. The story that best describes this in her collection is titled Everything is Nice, which describes an interaction between a non-native woman with a mysteriously absent husband and a Muslim Moroccan woman carrying a porcupine in a basket. It explores the cultural differences between them, but more than that, it enters into the subconscious realms of how life is viewed through two different cultures. At the end of the story, she describes the narrator's departure. She started up the steep alley, headed once again for the walk along the cliff. The houses on either side of her were so close that she could smell the dampness of the walls and feel it on her cheeks like a thicker air. When she reached the place where she had met Zodelia, she went over to the wall and leaned against it. Although the sun had sunk behind the houses, the sky was still luminous, and the blue of the wall had deepened. She rubbed her fingers along it. The wash was fresh, and a little of the powdery stuff came off. And she remembered how once she had reached out to touch the face of a clown because it had awakened some longing. It had happened at a little circus, but not when she was a child. Jane Bowles, inspired no doubt by the complexity of her own life, was an expert on strangeness. In her stories, odd things happen. Corsets end up in fountains and necklaces in the gravy boat. Women express their rage and wake up the next morning in places they don't remember. With commentary on queer literature and life, this is Janet Mason for This Way Out.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
A new This Way Out update has been posted on our website. For recent programming information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to www.thiswayout.org.
Waiting for Giovanni is a play in progress about pivotal moments in the life of pioneering gay African-American civil rights activist and writer James Baldwin. This Way Out correspondents Dixie Trichel and John Townsend talk with actor Harry Waters Jr. and playwright Jewel Gomez about their unique collaboration and the people and key events in Baldwin's life that are inspiring it.
What brought you to become interested in James Baldwin?
One of the things that Jim and I are interested in is looking not only at just his story, but how to tell this story in a unique way, because mm-hmm. he was such a unique person. And having a writer write about a writer, I think, was an inspired choice.
Baldwin had been one of the first African-American writers I ever read, and my life was changed when I was a teenager and I read Another Country. So the idea for me was how to take someone who is such a towering genius and explore the emotional vulnerability of him, to open up the public to the idea of him as someone who was as afraid, as wounded, as anxiety-ridden as any artist and any human being ever is. And that, to me, made his work all the more brilliant. His religious background, what about his father and that kind of madness? What does verbal abuse mean, and what does it mean to be thought of as black and ugly, and what does it mean to be gay when everybody in the black community is pretending like there are no gay people, mm-hmm. or in the black movement is pretending there are no gay people? What does all that mean? There's a cacophony of voices in his head, and I decided I wanted to create a kind of dream play in which we get to hear all of these voices in his head. In addition to Jimmy, it includes his brother, who was a dear friend and supporter for most of his life. It includes characters from his novels. The play is called, it'll be called, Waiting for Giovanni. The moment that I chose to explore is just as Baldwin is waiting for Giovanni's room to be published. And his anxiety about a book that he had to write, he was driven to write this apocalyptic kind of story that features a man in love with another man in a fateful relationship. It's a book that he's been told will ruin his career. That being an African-American spokesperson, activist, making a choice to write about a, quote, homosexual affair will ruin him. I think capturing that moment, I had to use real characters. I had to use his fictional characters.
We are really in development. To me, the most exciting part of being an artist is what's the process that we're creating? What characters seem to have more life or may go away? But what we really do is together is we're hearing how this story needs to be told.
Collaboration is such a fabulous way to create art.
Jewel had written a piece, and you can probably speak more on it, thoughts of Lorraine Hansberry connecting with Jimmy and talking to him. I would like to know Jewel's inspiration about doing the Lorraine Hansberry voice.
I'm so in love with Lorraine Hansberry. You know, it's one of those things where, God, I wish I had been old enough in her sphere. I would have raced in and thrown myself at her because I just thought she was such a brilliant writer, and she was struggling to be herself in the same way I think that Jimmy was, in a world that would deny her as a woman who loved women. That she died early is one of the great sadnesses still in my world. I have always thought about her, and this seemed like an opportunity to bring them together. And I wanted to have her be able to explore what the tragedies of the civil rights movement meant to her. So I started thinking about a monologue that was an emotional monologue in which she was trying to suppress the emotion, because I think a lot of her life was about suppressing the hurts that had befallen her. And I came up with this image, it's always stuck with me, a picture in Jet magazine, I believe, when I was a kid, that showed the mother of Emmett Till. When Emmett Till's body was returned to her after being brutally beaten and drowned, wrapped in barbed wire, when his body came back, his mother, Mamie, insisted they open the coffin in public because she did not want this to be a hidden thing, what had been done to her young son. And there's a picture, not of the body that stayed with me, but of her and her collapse into the arms of two men who were with her, and just the beauty of her face. It's like an African mask, and just how horrific that must have been for her. So I wrote a monologue of Lorraine Hansberry coming from a memorial for Emmett Till and being unable to shake the image of Emmett Till's mother. And all the while she's talking about it, she's setting the table for a dinner party. That feeling of women's work. Women are never done, and women are denigrated for the work they do. No matter what we do, it's not good enough. And she connects with Jimmy because they're both in a similar position as writers who would be marginalized by the black nationalist faction. Neither one of them are deemed worthy enough. And the jealousy of Hansberry because of her notoriety and being produced on Broadway and getting the Drama Circle Award, it shows that the fractionalization that threatens to destroy any kind of liberation, really.
These two icons are celebrated now in their death. But while they were working, it was like, who do you think you are to be able to do this kind of work?
Right.
And I remember, I used to live in New York on 110th Street, and Baldwin's funeral had everyone there at St. John the Divine. But these were the same people that were saying, who is this little black faggot? So these two forces of our history coming together and just having this moment that they're sharing their experience, it does affect what James then writes later. There's an idea that, yes, we can read Baldwin because he was an important writer, but we don't really want to talk about who he was sleeping with, his inspirations for his stories.
And who was his lover?
Luke in France took care of James and inspired him to write and kept him writing. And
but Luke never envisioned himself married to Jimmy. You know, he was a much more French in terms of his sexuality. So Jimmy was in love, and Luke loved him, but wasn't necessarily in love. You know, Jimmy had a series of lovers. He was particularly fond of dark young boys who were adoring of him. And I postulate at some point in that monologue that in some ways it was as if with Luke, Jimmy found his perfect lover, but in the young, dark men that he picked up often, Was he looking for himself? Mm-hmm. Was he looking for the beautiful self that had been ripped away from him by his father's nasty rejections of him?
And here's just a few words from that monologue. With others, the young dark men I meet in bars and cafes, I wonder who they represent, other than the obvious, the overtly sexual, the simplification of life's energy to its most raw form. They don't fight me as Luke does. When I look into their eyes, when I talk to them like a book, what am I seeing? Myself? Am I loving myself when I feel their sweat mingle with my own? Now, I am not an expert on desire, black or any other type, but I do know that one legacy of slavery is a fear, a deep fear of desire. Now, the death of Emmett Till should tell us that, if nothing else. So frightened were those white men that a mere boy dared to express sexual desire for a white woman, they had to torture and murder him. So afraid of life, they had to crush it. Now, when his hand touches me, that dark boy, when his eyes meet mine, sweat pours forth and floods those dry riverbeds of desire. How dare anyone try to keep us from the water?
That was actor Harry Waters Jr. and playwright Jewel Gomez discussing Waiting for Giovanni, their play in progress about pivotal events in the life of civil rights activist and writer James Baldwin. They were interviewed by Dixie Trichel and John Townsend. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Sherry Lunn, Lee Moore, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, Janet Mason, and Dixie Trichel and John Townsend contributed program material, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air. Email us at tworadio@aol.com or write to P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on CJSR Edmonton, Alberta, Contact FM Hamilton, New Zealand, MVS Radio Amsterdam, the Netherlands, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Just one glimpse of you is all I need. Knowing that you breathe the same air I breathe. But perhaps I should start with something simple. Like, what's your name? What is your history? What is your game? What is your pleasure? What is your pain? I want to know, what is your name? Maybe we could go outside for a walk, spend some time together and we could talk. I want to know. The full of glances you throw my way. I want to know all there is to know. I want to know what makes your heart grow. But perhaps I should start with something simple. Like, what's your name? What is your history?
be your friend. I could be a lover till the very end, but there's something I should know before we begin. Oh, what's your name? What is your history? What is your game? What is your pleasure? What is your pain? I want to know, what is your name? Maybe we could go outside for a walk, spend some time together, we could talk. I want to know, what is your name? What's your name? What is your history? What is your game? What gives your pleasure? What is your pain? I want to know, what is your name? Maybe we could go outside for a walk, spend some time together, we could talk.
Is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
thanks to J.D. Doyle for supplying the music for us this evening. That was a group called Ex-Boyfriends from their CD released last year called Within, that was Situation. And before that, Roger Kuhn, What's Your Name, from his 2006 CD called Proof. This is Queer Voices.
So, has anybody been to the new Koth Cathedral?
No. You know, back in my hippie days, when I lived virtually downtown.
The $40 million Koth Cathedral?
Yeah. Think how many people could actually be the homeless that could be helped. And
just think if they put that money into Catholic charities.
Exactly. The picture, because, you know, my idea of what spiritual is not all that marble and gold and, you know.
I guess the Houston-Galveston Diocese didn't have all the other problems that some of the other dioceses had.
Well, I'm sure they had some of them, but maybe not to the degree. I don't think they had.
Maybe they sent those problems to other dioceses.
Which is what most of them did in the pedophile cases. But, you know, it's all those men in dresses. It was a very gay event. But the picture that they had in the front page of the Chronicle has these cardinals and bishops going up. And you may not realize this, but the churches are built along the lines of the female body.
Really?
Yes.
Didn't
we'll
know that.
We'll talk about this sometime.
Oh, I would definitely
like to hear
about this.
Because, you know, you have to go and have a man up there at the altar in order to connect with God, because how else can they do it? Because it's from women that people come. But anyway.
Well, this is controversial. We just have to do a whole show on it.
That picture, it looked so ghostly. They were like these white robes, and they're going up the center aisle, and it just looked like weird.
Well, you probably just needed a gay choreographer to take you know, do it. The other
not
thing
that there's not any in the priesthood.
Yes. Well, and speaking of other new things, Discovery Green Park opens up on Sunday.
Yes.
And where exactly is that?
That is right in front of the convention center. In fact, as we're talking about protesting, it's in front of the Hilton Americas. It is just west.
Hotel of the Americas.
Yes,
I think Hotel they call of it. Americas. Hilton Hotel of the Americas. Is Paris going to be there? It's one of the shows.
Even she probably knows better.
Yeah. Just to remind folks again that this Saturday night, I started to call it the Human Rights Closet. The Human Rights Campaign, which considers itself one of the premier gay, lesbian, bisexual organizations. They seem to forget about the T's.
Yeah, forget about the transsexual, transgender portion of it.
Yes, but they are having a big event which raises money, which I'm still not sure where all the money goes and who it helps. Matthew Shepard's mother,
right.
Judy, is the keynote speaker. And I'd like to be able to say, oh, it's a good thing, and, you know, people that can afford to go should go and all like that. But because I support my transgender brothers and sisters and feel like they should be included, if I possibly can be there to be part of the protest, I will be protesting with Phyllis and the others.
On a positive note, tomorrow is election day.
Yes, if y'all haven't gone, if you didn't early vote,
voter registration,
you need to get out
right
and
here.
Go elected. Check HarrisVotes.org.
Because I can't go where I would usually go in my precinct. Shout out to Precinct 59 in the Heights. And so we have to find out where we have to go vote. It'll also be listed in the Chronicle,
I'm
not imagine.
Sure it will be. Usually it is.
I imagine so.
Okay, you early, imagine that.
Yeah, well.
But don't
well,
keep,
but you
I
got
would
an
suggest,
email to tell you where to go.
Because I have it from thecaucus.org.
That's right. The caucus sent out emails to people to let them know where they do vote.
And to
if
remind,
you didn't receive one and you're a supporter of the GLBT community, you need to contact the caucus at thecaucus.org. Let us know. Give us your email address and we'll keep you informed on the next election.
And also, you will discover who the caucus-endorsed candidates are.
Absolutely. And for the Railroad Commission, it was Dale Henry. And for the 80th Civil District Court, it was Larry Wyman.
And those are both Democrats.
Yes, they are. This now, is the Democratic primary. No Republican came and talked to the caucus this year.
No?
Well, no, excuse me. Several did, but none were endorsed.
Do you know Noel Freeman, who was a log cabin Republican, has left the party?
Yes. He saw the light. He was reborn.
Well, that's lovely. We like that when that happens. Next week we have a number of things planned.
Like what?
We're not sure what all, but we will have Eric Rowland from Legacy Community Services talking about some programs there. We will have some people from Equality Texas Houston, which kind of is a reborn version of the Houston Equal Rights Alliance. And we might have some lesbians who play softball. I mean, I don't know. I can't figure that out.
Play a little hardball.
Anyway, thank you.
I'll be on vacation and be back on the 21st.
Okay, and thanks to Allison Boat, David Elliott, and Phyllis Fry for being with us tonight. And join us next week for Queer Voices. This is Deborah Bell.
Jennifer Renee.
Jack Falinski.
Glenn Holt.
And Brian Lavinka.
Good night.
Another great show. You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
KPFT wants to give a big welcome to our friends from around the Pacifica Network. That's because the Pacifica National Board meeting is being hosted in our city. KPFT welcomes listeners to attend public sessions for these meetings. These gatherings will be held at the Crown Plaza, Houston, downtown. The meetings happen Friday through Sunday, April 11th to the 13th. Public comments, hearings will occur throughout the weekend. For a complete agenda, visit PacificaFoundation.org. The Crown Plaza, Houston.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.